We are actually pivoting in a series we've been on. We called it Chariots of Fire, but you know, it's kind of the same thing, but we changed titles here. But now we're just naming it Elisha. He's the guy who comes after Elijah. And last week, seems like a year ago, we had our pivot sermon where we switched from Elijah to Elisha. Elijah actually puts in his resignation. God accepts it. And so then we're going to get introduced to our new character, Elisha. Elijah is going to be hanging around for a little while, but Elisha will become the main character. Now, some of you may remember from the first week, probably no one remembers because I asked my wife and she didn't. I said, do you remember what Elijah's name was? Elijah's name means my God is Yahweh. And Elisha's name means my God is salvation, which I found interesting. Maybe no one else did. But anyways, that's what Elisha's name means. We're going to be introduce him today. But remember that what happened was, Elijah did this great meeting on Mount Carmel. Fire came down. There was a big repentance. But Jezebel decides she's not repentant. She's going to try to kill Elijah. Elijah takes it very personally. And he runs off to Mount Horeb, where he meets the Lord and says, basically, I'm done. And actually, he asked God to kill him. He said, just kill me. I don't want her to have the privilege. And God says, no, I'm not going to kill you, but here's what I want you to do. I want you to go. And he gives him two kings to anoint. And I don't have time to go into this. The kings he chooses are very interesting because they're kind of evil kings. But God uses them to bring judgment on Ahab, the king of Israel at the time. And so then he also, at the very end of it, says, Elijah, you shall anoint as a prophet in your place. So he's actually going to pick his successor. And so that's where we left off with Elijah. Now, before we leave Elijah, I've got to say a couple things. First of all, this is the first time in the Bible that we see what's really the calling of a disciple. There's a lot of things, we've talked about this before, how the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed, the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed. There's a lot of things that happen in the Old Testament that kind of point the way to what will happen later in the New Testament. And this is one of them. Elijah, for the first time, goes and picks a disciple. Well, he doesn't pick him, God does, but he goes, he calls a disciple. And I want to show that in parallel to Jesus calling disciples. I thought it was interesting. So that's one thing. The other thing about Elijah is he was a very, I don't want to say he was an angry prophet, but he kind of comes off a bit angry. He loves to call fire from the sky, and I've talked about that before. We're not going to really go into the passage where he does this. I don't preach on this, but I just want to show it to you because I've said before, he calls it down more than once. Famously, he does it on Mount Carmel, but Elijah liked the fire thing. He called it a lot, and boy, I tell you what, if I could, I would. That's got to be the coolest thing in the world, to pray fire down. But in this case, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to show you when he does this. This is Elijah hangs around. Now, he's no longer the preeminent prophet that God uses, but every now and then he'll use him. He'll call him out. And Elijah kind of has a school of prophets where they're teaching people to be prophets and raising up leaders, spiritual leaders. So he kind of gets more involved as a mentor. But every now and then, they put the old guy back in the game. And so what happens is one of the other kings feels he got leprosy, and so he sends a messenger to the temple of Baal in the next country over to see whether or not he can be healed. And the God of Israel takes offense at that and sends Elijah to meet the messengers and say, you have a God in Israel you can go to. You don't need to go seek God advice from other gods. These guys must have known who Elijah was. And they turned around and ran back to the king, said, we can't go. Elijah was standing on our way. So the king gets upset by that. So he sends a captain with 50 men to go arrest him. This guy's causing trouble again. I'm just going to go ahead and arrest him. So he sends a captain, and clearly this captain has no idea who he's dealing with when it comes to Elijah, because he goes up and he kind of gets a little bit cocky with him when he sees him. And so he sends to Elijah a captain with 50 men, and behold, he was sitting on the top of the hill, and there's Elijah, old man sitting on the top of the hill, and oh, this guy's senile, look at him. The captain says, oh, man of God. There's a little bit of mockery in this. The king says, come down, come away from the ledge, Mr. Old Man. I'm going to take you to the king now, and we'll give you pudding. Just like, come on down. And Elijah turns around and says, you call me a man of God. If I were a man of God, I could call fire down from heaven right now to kill you. And boom, just like that, fire falls from heaven and consumes all of them. And this scene actually plays out two more times. The king doesn't learn. He sends another captain with 50 till the last guy goes up and just like hits the ground immediately. Oh, Lord Elijah, please don't kill me. I have a family. But, Elijah just doesn't mess around. He said, I'm not going to deal with the minions. He calls fire down and destroys them. The reason I'm bringing that story up is because it's the only time in the Bible we see this. We don't see any other time when any prophet of God calls fire down with a prayer specifically to destroy something. And we see, of course, the plagues in Egypt and things, and there's like hail that comes out of fire. But this act of calling fire down in judgment on somebody who's not showing respect to the prophet doesn't happen anywhere else in the Bible. And the reason this is important is because in the Gospel of Luke, he throws in this one little detail, which I believe is calling our attention back to this story in Elijah's life. So let me show you this. So when the days were approaching for his ascension, Jesus was determined to go on to Jerusalem. Now we're still in Luke 9. This is about halfway through the book of Luke. He sent messengers ahead of him to Jerusalem, and they entered the village of the Samaritans to make arrangements because he's walking through there on their way to Jerusalem. But they would not receive him because he's going on to Jerusalem. In other words, you're not staying here, Jesus. You're just passing through. Well, forget it. We're not going to accommodate you with any kind of special thing. And so his disciples get a little bit upset. And now remember, when Jesus sent out the 70 disciples, he did give them this instruction. He said, if you ever go to a house and they don't receive you, take off your sandals, shake the dust off, and leave. He says, I tell you, in the final day, it'll be worse for them than Sodom and Gomorrah. He's like, they rejected you. You shake off the dust, symbolizing you reject them. And if you reject them, look out, come judgment day, right? So he's kind of already given a prescription on how to handle this kind of a thing. The disciples don't go to that description. They go all the way back to Elijah. Then the disciples, James and John, they call them the sons of thunder. You'll see why. Hey, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them all, just destroy them? Let's just burn them up. They don't really like the Samaritans anyway, you know. Can we just call fire down on them? And so I believe this whole thing is kind of put in there to call our attention to the thought of Elijah before we get to what happens next. Because what's going to happen next in Jesus' life is a bunch of wannabe disciples are going to come to him. And he's going to have conversations with each of them. So, you know, those of you who like to do this, stick your finger in the Bible there in Luke. And let's go back now to Elijah. I want to show you what happens here. So Elijah departs from where he was, and he goes and he finds Elisha while he was plowing with 12 pair of oxen before him. And he was with the 12. That's a really important verse. We'll come back to that. And Elijah, watch as he passes over to him and threw his mantle on him. Now I want you to picture this. Elijah was well known. People knew him, right? They knew him by the look of him. He was kind of a scraggly man, and he was a little bit rough, wore leathers, and, you know, he's a tough guy. And so people knew who Elijah was. That's how those servants could recognize him when they saw him. Elisha knows full well who just walked up to him. Now, I want you to kind of put yourself in the position of Elisha for a second. I don't know who you greatly revere in the world of Christianity, you know. I don't know, some kind of great mega star preacher, you know, on TV or something, or some teacher, you know, whether it's Billy Graham or, you know, whether it's, you know, Stanley or MacArthur, whoever you think is this really great preacher, you know, Stephen Furtick, if you must, Diane. But so anyway, if you know, just keep, you know, this, whoever it is that you're like, really think that person's great. Now imagine you're at work one day and they come walking in, and maybe a coat they wear all the time they preach in. They take off the coat and throw it on your desk or whatever you do for a living and throw it on you and turn around and walk away. What would you do? I mean, this is like the strangest scene in the Bible, just about. And the Bible's full of strange scenes. Here he is walking along. He just throws his mantle on him and keeps walking. He doesn't stop. He doesn't explain what he's doing. He just throws the mantle on him and keeps moving. Like, you'll know what to do. Now, how does Elijah know what to do? Well, one thing we must know about Elijah is he must have been really tuned in to God. I mean, God didn't just pick him at random. He picked him for a reason. He probably was taught in scriptures. Certainly later in his life, we see he has a very deep understanding of scriptures. So he probably had the chance to be tutored, and he understood a lot of prophecies, and he understood what it meant when the prophet of the Lord passed his mantle over to him. He knew what was being asked of him. Now, what he does is he leaves his oxen. Like, he's plowing, right? He stops. He goes running after Elijah and says, whoa, 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 whoa. I wasn't ready for this. You know, nobody told me you were coming. Can I go home and say goodbye to my father and mother first? I got to tell them what I'm doing. I got to tell them I'm leaving. And you would think at that point that, you know, Elijah would say, yeah, that makes sense. But we'll come back to the story of Elijah and Elijah for a second now. I know this is irritating. I'm going to jump back in the New Testament, because I want to show you what happens when Jesus has people come up to him. And he's been preaching now for a while. He's been doing miracles. His disciples have done miracles. And people want to get on board. You know, a lot of people came to Jesus saying, hey, I want to be like one of your disciples. That's amazing. I want to do that. And so as they're going along the road, someone runs up and says, hey, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus says, careful what you ask for. He says, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but I have no place to lay my head. I don't have a home. I don't have a bed I go to. Are you sure you want to follow me? He's trying to make sure these people understand what they're asking for. And then he turns to another one there. And he says, well, why don't you follow me? And then he says, well, Lord, I will, but permit me first to go bury my father. Which isn't so different, right, from what Elisha says to Elijah. Hey, let me go home and talk to my mom and my dad. Now, in this case, he's saying, well, my dad died. I have to go bury him. Here's the question. If your dad died, what are you doing here? You know, this is like an excuse, right? He was like, he wasn't that interested in the funeral, or he would have been at the funeral. He said, well, let me go home and bury my father. Or perhaps some theologians believe his father wasn't dead yet. He's saying, when my father passes away and I bury him, then I will come follow you. Either way, Jesus says, let the dead bury the dead. As for you, you go proclaim the gospel. Now, this is amazing now because Jesus Christ has told this man he has the gift of preaching, because he wouldn't have sent him without the gift of preaching. He said, you'd be a good preacher. We could use you in the kingdom. Jesus Christ himself said, you have a gift of preaching. I can't imagine what that'd be like. I need you to go preach. He's like, yeah, my father's old. I'm going to wait till he passes away, and then I'll come and find you. Okay, so this is kind of what Jesus was dealing with the second wave of disciples, if you want to call them that, the ones who came to him, not the ones he called, the ones who came to him. And we see some similarity a little bit between Elisha's reluctance to follow Elijah and these guys' reluctance to really follow Jesus. And I want to show you what Elijah does next because it made no sense to me. I actually spent a couple days studying what he says here, because he says, he came up, he says, let me kiss my father and my mother and I'll follow you. And then Elijah says this to him, well, go back. What have I done to you? And like, well, that's a bizarre statement. You know, go back. What have I done for you? Or what I've done to you, however you translate the Hebrew there. I was like, I don't get that. I don't understand what happened there. He was told to call him. He called him. Elijah makes what I thought was a pretty reasonable request. And he says, well, go back. What have I done for you? I'm like, what's that? So I actually spent a lot of time searching on that and reading a couple doctorate thesis on the Hebrew here. And actually what he says basically is this. Hey, I was told to give you the opportunity. I did my job. Decision's yours. He said, you want to go back? Go back. I'm not calling the shots in your life yet. Now, if he says yes to the calling, that's going to change, because when he says yes, he's going to become Elijah's servant. And for the next rest of his life, until Elijah passed away, every decision in his life will be made for him by Elijah. But Elijah's saying, it's not yet. I'm not now in charge of your life. You go do whatever you want. You want to go back and see your parents? You go ahead. But notice Elijah has never stopped walking. I'm going this way. You coming or not? Right? He never paused. He never slowed down. He just simply said, I'm not here to make your decision. I am here to give you the chance to make a decision. And I thought, that's really the gospel. You'll see this all throughout the gospel. You'll see it with Jesus. Jesus doesn't chase people. He just doesn't. The apostles don't chase people. They say, hey, look, this is the will of God. This is the word of God. Here it is. You can do whatever you want with it. My job is to give it to you. Your job is to make your decision up and decide what you're going to do. And I think a lot of people have that a little bit confused. And the reason that it confuses is because they don't really understand what God is in their life. And if you understand what God is, you understand why Elijah didn't stop walking. And you understand why Jesus says, you go preach or not, but let the dead bury the dead if you're going to do this. Just follow me. And why you can do that if you're Jesus or Elijah or Paul or any of those guys is because of where they knew God stood in their lives. And the best way I can describe this, and this is a little bit far afield, I know, but let me give you an example. The way people view God is the way people view the sun. Bear with me. It's a metaphor. Because I meet a lot of people. And I talk to them here in church. I talk to them outside of church. When people find out I'm a preacher, I talk to them about all kinds of things about the church that they hate, that hurt them or whatever. I get in all kinds of conversations with people about God and about church. And I would kind of roughly break the people I talk to into three categories. The first one I'm calling daylighters. Now, the daylighters are the people who understand that light comes because of something. They understand there's daylight and there's nightfall. And they understand that daylight affects their lives. They get that, you know. If I go out in the daylight and I don't have sunscreen on and it's hot, I'll burn myself. I get that. I understand. I can see better in the daylight than I can at night. So I like that. They understand that there's something out there that's affecting their life. Now, if you meet these people, here's how it looks like from a Christian standpoint. They don't call themselves Christian. They call themselves spiritual. Have you ever met a spiritual person? I'm just kind of basically spiritual. Okay, what they're saying is, I understand there's something out there, some spiritual force, and I understand that sometimes it impacts my life, but I don't understand it, and I don't want to. I just like to get around it as best I can. You know, the daylighters, you know, the people who are daylighters in terms of the sun, is, you know, they don't want to get burned. They want to know when they can plant their fields or when they can, you know, play their games. They want to know what they could do so they can live their life to the maximum. And they know daylight impacts that, and so they want to know just enough to get by. And I meet a lot of people like that. I understand that God might kind of sort of be out there, and I understand he impacts me. I want to see how I can best stay out of his way so he doesn't hurt me. You know, that'd be good. That's what I want to kind of get a sense of this spirit thing just to the point where it doesn't interrupt my life. The second level I meet, and by the way, that's like most of the people outside of these walls, I would say, when I meet them, they're daylighters outside. I don't mean many of them here. I've met some here. They come in, and they're honest. Hey, I don't know what I think about this religion thing. It's just kind of a spiritual thing. But mostly I meet those outside the walls. Inside the walls, I mostly meet what I call the sundowners. Now, the sundowners understand that there's a sun out there, and the daylight comes from the sun. So they've actually traced it back to the source. And they see it, and it rises and it sets. You know, I know the sun rises and it sets. Sometimes it takes longer to rise and set. Don't fully understand that. But they rise and set, and sometimes it's hotter than other times. I know that. But I know it's all based around the sun somehow. And these are the people come and say, I know there's a God. There is a God. There's a person, the God. And I don't fully understand him because sometimes he seems to be there and sometimes he's not. And sometimes I feel him and sometimes I don't. And I don't fully get all that, but I know he's there. You know, I know somehow he's there. And so I kind of need to figure this out a little bit more, because if I could figure out a little bit more, I could live a better life. I want to have a more productive life. And if I could just get to that point, I'd be better at this. And I'd say, I'm going to tell you, probably 90% of the people I meet inside these walls are sundowners. I kind of get that it's God's there, he's real. I want to know how he really affects my life, though I don't fully get it. And man, sometimes he just seems to disappear, and sometimes he's hotter than others. I don't get all that, but I'd like to know a little more, right? But my whole thing is, I still want to live a better life. I want my life to be better, and I get that if I can understand the sun a little bit more, it'll be better, so let me do that. And then there's a 10%. These people I call the astronomers, because they have a whole different view. They know that the sun is the center of the universe. And that just changes everything. And suddenly, for the first time, they understand that the day and the night comes not because the sun's changing, but because we are. And the reason it gets warmer sometimes than other isn't because the sun changes, it's because the Earth changes in its orbit. And so I start understanding that everything revolves around the sun. And that changes. Now I understand seasons. I understand ups and downs. I also understand that the Earth isn't nearly as important as I thought it was, let alone me, because I'm not the center of the universe. There are some people who've made that discovery about God. They say, wait. God is the center of everything. Oh, I get it now. And when I feel God or don't feel God, God never moved. I did. And when I have these moments of light and dark in my life, it's not that God changed. I did. I'm the one doing it. I'm the one in the orbit. I'm the one spinning around. And so what I need to do is I need to understand God's the center, and I revolve around him. And if you ever get to the point where you realize God's the center of your life and every decision you make is based on God in your life, you will start living a life that's different. For one thing, people won't understand your choices anymore. So that's just nuts. Why would you do that? I mean, I'll never forget, this is before we opened the church. We were moving from Texas to Virginia, and I was talking to a guy that I knew in church up there, and he says, and we were looking for a home. We couldn't find a house. We're like, oh, you know, we're like going back and trying to find a house before we moved. Didn't have anything lined up. And so I was telling him about this. He says, did you find a church? Because if you knew the church, then you'd know where to look for the house. That'd be good. Do you have your church? I said, I don't have a church. I don't have a house yet. How can I have a church, right? And I thought, and I hung up the phone. I told Victoria, how weird. He thinks I should pick my church first and then pick my house. But see, his life was revolving around God. He's saying, well, you need a good church before you move into a new area. Pick that first and then pick a house near the church. But I didn't have that idea at all. I had not yet become an astronomer. I was still a sundowner. And I was like, that's just nuts. And so we went and we picked a house and then tried to find a church. That's a hard job to do. But I didn't even understand him because I just wasn't where he was. But when you put God in the center of your life, you just start making different choices and everything goes around. So let me get back to Jesus now because that's what happens next. Now, remember that he's calling these people and this person comes up and he says exactly what Elijah says. Hey, I'm going to follow you, Lord, but first permit me to say goodbye to those at home. That is Elijah right there. It's exactly what Elijah says. And watch what Jesus' response to him is. No one, after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. No. I've told you to go. And remember when Jesus called Peter as a disciple, he tells him, I'm going to make you fishers of men. He has a tendency to use what we know in our life and turn around and explain himself through that, right? And I believe that, honestly, this is a callback to Elisha. This is probably what Elijah should have said to Elisha, but he didn't. Basically, he said, I'm giving you an opportunity to plow for the Lord. You want to sit here and plow? Go ahead. But if you're going to touch God's plow, don't turn around and look back. Because if you look back, you're not fit for the work that's before you. Jesus was a hard-line kind of person. There was a reason why multitudes didn't follow him around. Because he was real about this. He says, look, are you going to do God's work or not? I'm calling you. Are you going to do God's work or not? And if you're going to put your hand on the plow, don't look back. Don't second-guess your decision. You commit to me, you commit to me. I'm the center of the universe. And when we get that, things change. Elijah was being offered the plow of the Lord. That's what Elijah was really offering him there. And I honestly believe, I don't have any scripture to back this up, I believe that Elijah had second thoughts about his resignation. I really do. Because this happens right after that. I believe that after God fed him with manna and rested him up and told him what was really going on, he thought, well, you know, maybe I was hasty with that whole Kilby thing, Lord. Maybe I don't want to. But it was too late. God said, I've accepted your resignation. Elijah's going to take over for you now. And I think he was really okay if Elijah decided no. I really do. It just seems like he's not really working very hard to get Elijah to come. He's like, come or don't come. It's up to you. But I want you to see what Elijah does next because it's really, really remarkable. Elijah left him and went back to the field, not home. He went back to the field, which is just, 100 yards away. He took his ox, the two ox he had there, and he slaughtered them. He burned the plowing equipment to cook the meat, and he gave it to the people, and they ate. And then he set out to follow Elijah and become his servant. This is amazing. Something that gets lost in all this is Elijah was stinking rich. I'm going to try to put this in our modern day terms, but Elijah was plowing a field, right? But he wasn't. He was plowing 12 fields. He had 12 oxen. That's one yoke. I mean, he had 12 yoke of oxen. That's 24 oxen. He had 12 fields because he had a setup for each field. He was in the 12th, which means he had servants in the other 11, all plowing to get the fields ready. This was one of the most fertile and rich areas in Israel. So he had an amazing farm. And he had you want to picture what an oxen, like two oxen is worth. Take whatever truck you love, guys. I don't know what it is. Your Ford guy, F-150 or your Chevy or GM, whatever. Pick your favorite truck, trick it out. That's like an ox. He had 24 of them. He was rich, amazingly rich. So when Elijah came up and said, hey, you want to follow me and become my servant and own nothing or not? What he was asking him to do is, are you ready to leave wealth behind and follow me or not? What do you want to do? And Elijah's response is not only say yes, he went back and burned everything behind him. He was saying, I am never coming back. He gave the meat away to the workers. He was throwing a party. I'm about to give up everything I own to go follow this crazy man. Celebrate with me. And so he gives them all the food and he burns his own plow to do it. There is no return for Elijah at this point. I'm done. I have no need for this. I'm going to go follow the Lord. And so he went off and he followed. Listen, we can't follow God if we keep looking back on what we left behind. So many people, they'll take a step forward, but they'll keep that other thing there. I got to have this plan B, you know. I can't quite let go of this. God's called me to let go of this, and I won't do it. I'm going to kind of keep it there. We drag it around with us. And then we wonder why it's always there pulling us back. It's like we attach ourselves to an anchor and wonder why we can't get ahead. And Elijah knew that. I mean, he was a wise man, and he understood this. He said, God's calling me. Guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to burn this. So there is never coming back for me. I'm making the decision right now. I'm cutting all ties, and that's that. I'm never going to look back. But this is what Jesus said too. He said, look, what a profit if you gain the whole world and lose your soul. Jesus says one soul is worth more than the entire world, is what he said. One soul, yours, is worth more than the whole world. And we're keeping stuff. I want my soul plus stuff. And Jesus says, you don't need that stuff. You need to follow me. I'll take care of you. Trust me. I'll take care of you. David said this in Psalm 73. He says, what do I have in heaven but you, Lord? But you know what? Besides you, I desire nothing on earth. He says, I have you in heaven, and if I look at you, I don't need anything else here on earth. I just don't. I have made my decision, Lord. I will follow you. Now, of course, God bless David. That's great when that happens, and I wish I could tell you that God always blesses this decision with lots of money and in case his wealth and power and everything else. He doesn't always. You know, he says, I need you to follow me. I'll work out the details. I need you to make the decision to follow me. Or you want to leave everything else behind? Paul put it this way. I once thought these things were valuable, but now I consider them worthless because of what Christ has done. By the way, Paul was a Pharisee, and Pharisees were rich. Paul also left riches to follow Jesus. He said, everything else is worthless when I compare it to the infinite value of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord. For his sake, I have discarded everything else, counting it all as garbage, because I got to gain Christ. See, we have a problem in America. We want to be rich Christians. And Jesus is saying, I just need you to be Christians. Or I want to be Christians that still get to go out and have fun with my crew and do all the things we always did. I want to be like a sinner but saved. Our little secret, God. Don't make me tell my friends. He says, no, I need you to follow me. We have to decide, are we the center of our universe or is God? That's the choice we have to make. And Jesus just puts it out there. And I'm just putting it out there. I can't make your decision for you. I can't make you follow Jesus. That's not my job. My job is to say, this is what the Bible says. This is the truth of God. Are you going to put God in the center of the universe? Or are you going to try to stay there? Because if you're going to try to stay there, Jesus considers you unfit for the kingdom of heaven. Just telling you. This is what he says. Elisha would go on to serve Elijah for about 20 years as a servant. 20 years taking care of that old guy. Crotchety old guy. 20 years. But then when Elisha took over, you won't believe some of the stuff that happens in Elisha's ministry. So we have this choice to make. And you say, well, I don't want to go on and do all these great things. Do you want to go on? I mean, people tell me, well, you know, you preach about how we could pray these great miracles. I don't want to pray great miracles. Really? I think every time we get before God, we should be praying for a miracle. Salvation's a miracle. I mean, everything's miracles. Having reconciliation in our family is a miracle. You know, healing's a miracle. Why would we not want to pray for miracles? Why are we trying to just get by? You know, what's the least amount of sin I can have and still get to heaven? That's the questions I get. They're not phrased that way, but that's basically what it is. I want to drag it with me. I want to drag it with me. Jesus, no. You cut it, you leave it behind. You do what Elijah did. Scorched earth, baby. You burn it and say, I'm never coming back. I'm burning it. If it's going to hold me down, I'm burning it, because that's rubbish. Jesus is calling. Jesus is calling me to something more than I can imagine. There was a famous, although very brief life of a guy named Jim Elliot. Some of you may know. His wife, Elizabeth Elliot, became quite an author. Jim Elliot was killed on the mission field. He followed Jesus, and it didn't turn out the way David's story did. He ended up being killed in the line of work for the Lord. Before he left, somebody was talking to him about this is the dumbest thing he's ever heard. That he had, because he was a young man, good-looking guy, athletic. He had all his life was in front of him, you know. And I know it seems when you're young, and athletic and good looking, I guess. I don't know, that last one. But if you are that, you get this feeling like it's going to last forever. Man, I remember when I was 22, I was immortal. You know, I would never, ever get old and age. And, you know, I would eat, no kidding, I don't brag about this, but I would eat a whole bag of double stuffed Oreo cookies every night. I couldn't gain an ounce. It was great. You know, I'd just burn it up. I could do anything. I played at the edges of some things that probably should have killed me, and they didn't. It's only the grace of God. Because eventually the averages run out, you know. If there's 1 in 100 and you keep playing that game enough, your number comes up. But I didn't think anything could happen to me. I was immortal. I was young. And so many times when you're caught up like that, it's like, well, why would you throw away your youth but follow Jesus? Go have fun. Go get it out of your system now. Later you can go make peace with Jesus. But then something happens. And you're 20 years old and you have a motorcycle accident. And you die. And you didn't have as much time as you thought you had. By the way, Greg was saved, but there's a lot of people that they're playing these games. You know, I've got plenty of time. I'm going to just go ahead and live this way, and I'm going to have plenty of time. And that's what they were telling. This friend was saying to Jim Elliot, says, you know, you're nuts. You've got your whole life in front of you. Why would you throw all that away to go to a mission field? And this was his famous reply. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. This is the choice he made. He said, why would I keep all this? I've got treasure in heaven that I can never lose. And he threw it all away to follow Jesus, and he's with him now. Look, we have to understand that there are things we're grabbing onto that are keeping us from God. And just like, you know, if you don't understand how the orbiting of the sun works, you know, when we spin around and God seems dark, he didn't change. We got distracted by these things we carry with us. When we don't feel the miracle of his light in our life, he didn't change. We've just pulled ourselves away from him and we're no longer close to him in orbit. God doesn't change. He's the center. What changes is our hearts and our actions. Are we going to put God in the center of our universe? Or are we going to try to keep ourselves there and be baffled why sometimes God seems close and sometimes he seems far away when I'm telling you it's just you? What is keeping you from the Lord? Would you please pray with me?